they changed, though. That's what I wanted to do, Garland said wonderingly. Make them realer. I told him, Caleb, what I could do with Quick Matter if I had half the chance. I knew I could make a place like this, make a better kind of game. But this place isn't anything to do with me, Dreyfus. You have to believe it. Dreyfus looked at him, gave a slow but considered nod. I do. For once I take you at your word. This is hard for you, I know. But we have to see it through. You really think he's here? I think he's been here for a very long time, Julius. Dreyfus turned to face Singh. You say there hasn't been any contact with the other party since the trouble started. Do you think you can retrace their steps? Singh pointed to an area of the clearing near the jungle wall. There was a path into the jungle, but it came and went. Dreyfus directed a question at the waiting whiphound. Can you retrace Prefect Singh's movements based on her tracker? The whiphound nodded, projecting a drunken scrawl onto his faceplate. There was a scribble of dense movement around their present location, then a meandering, looping trail which went out and back again. The general thrust of the course was towards the middle of the dome, but Singh had still had some way to go when she turned back. Get us to the point where the party separated, Dreyfus said. Straightest possible route. Forward scout mode, 5 meter secure zone. Proceed. The whiphound moved off, heading to the spot in the jungle wall that Singh had indicated. Dreyfus followed, but kept a wary distance, holding his hand up to urge Singh and Garland to exercise the same caution. Not that either of them were exactly straining to dive into the jungle. Dreyfus, Garland began, sounding very much like a man about to unburden himself of a confession. Later, Dreyfus said. The whiphound met the wall, whisking its filament in a fan-shaped blur, like a rattlesnake reversing with its tail upraised. Brilliant flecks of green began to fly away from the cutting edge. The whiphound started to excavate a slow, stoop-ceilinged tunnel into the jungle mass. Dreyfus watched, saying nothing, trusting in nothing. He had no expectation of success, but he could not very well lecture Singh on the demands of field service if he himself did not explore all possible opportunities, however doubtful they appeared. Dreyfus, listen to me. There's something near us. I can tell. How? I don't know. A prickly feeling that we're being watched, but more definite than that. Look, you've been trying to convince everyone I have secret powers until now. Don't be the one to doubt me when I tell you I can sense something. I know they're still out there, Singh said. Is it working, Prefect Dreyfus?
Too soon to be sure, he said.
The whiphound had burrowed 5 or 6 meters into the jungle. It was still moving, and the tunnel walls, cut back neatly like ornamental hedges, were not yet closing in after it. But Dreyfus knew there was nothing special about his whiphound, compared to the units the others had been carrying. Now pink and blue sparks lit the green tunnel. It's encountering resistance. It won't be safe for us to follow. Dreyfus reached out, opening his hand in a clear retrieval gesture.
Come back, he stated, just in case the whiphound needed persuading.
The whiphound abandoned its cutting and began to retreat along the tunnel. It was slower than it should have been, as if some damage had already been done to its core systems. But with a certain numb resignation, Dreyfus watched as a vine extended itself from the wall and snagged the whiphound. The vine coiled around it. Then the whiphound was gone, snatched into the green mass, a flash and a flicker showing through the foliage.
We think one of the other whiphounds blew up, Singh said. I don't know if Prefect Bankal and the others got away in time. Perhaps we should get back down in the pit, in case this one explodes.
That's the last place we want to be, Dreyfus said. We still need to find a way out of this clearing.
He unclipped his second whiphound and set it on a cordon patrol, lapping around the party but refraining from straying too close to the clearing's edge. Then he raised his voice to a shout.
Caleb! Can you hear me? I'm certain you know we're here. There's no reason for you not to.
He lowered his voice before it turned hoarse, his breath fogging the M-suit visor until it cleared itself.
Or for me to shout through this suit, I suppose, he added more softly. If you're there at all, you'll be aware of every word we've said.
You sound like a madman, Garland said, screaming at the trees.
I'm hoping to persuade your brother to grant us an audience. You don't even know if he's real, let alone that he'll want to speak to us.
To us? Maybe not, Dreyfus admitted, but to you. Why wouldn't he jump at the chance of a brotherly reunion? Although I suppose that rather depends on what led to the two of you going your separate ways, and you with no memory of him.
Dreyfus!
Singh said sharply. He turned, picking up the warning in her voice. A low, black form was taking shape near the fallen cat. It seemed to puddle out of the green, coalescing out of convergent threads of liquid blackness, clotting together into a single animal whole. The whiphound detected its presence and deflected its cordon patrol to approach the cat. "Wait until it's nearer," Dreyfus said quietly, as Singh made to raise the crossbow. "I trust your aim, but the bolt will have more power the nearer it is."
"It was just luck the first time."
"I doubt it very much, Deeper. You knew what to do then, and you know what to do now. But make the shot count. It's all we have." The cat was now fully whole, the last of the black strands separating from the jungle and vanishing into the animal's void-like silhouette. It prowled to the fallen cat, sniffing around it with a brittle, easily distracted curiosity. It touched a paw to the blackness. Two voids connected. Then it withdrew. If it detected some kinship in the murdered creature, the effect was slight and soon forgotten. The cat locked its attention onto Dreyfus, Singh, and Garlin. Two eyes, the white teeth. It walked closer, one footfall, then two, with a slow but gaining intent, until its steps became strides, the strides elongating, the cat seeming to flatten itself into a perfect moving darkness, following an invisible parabola. The whiphound intercepted it, the cat pawing it aside with an effortless disregard, the whiphound sparking and flashing as it fell to the ground, writhing like a poisoned snake. Then the cat was running, and Singh leveled the crossbow.
"Wait,"
Dreyfus mouthed, but Singh knew better, for she had done this once before. The crossbow snapped, and the dart launched itself into the cat. It was fast, very fast. Dreyfus barely had time to track it before it sank into the cat's chest, just below the neck. It was a good shot. The cat dropped with a sudden, conclusive urgency, as if cables had yanked it to the ground. He should have trusted Singh to know what she was doing.
"I'll get the dart," Dreyfus said,
fixing his eyes on the spot where it had gone in.
"No,"
Singh said. There was another cat, clotting into solidity at the clearing's edge. In that instant, Dreyfus knew with total certainty there would never be time to retrieve the dart. The cat attacked, duplicating the slow but rising tempo of the other, but this time with nothing to stop it. No whiphound, no dart, no armor that would make the slightest difference against a weapon made of predatory quick matter. Garlin raised a hand, palm flattened and upraised. Through his M-suit, Dreyfus saw a tremble and a curl to his lip, a sneer of cold command. Garland's arm stiffened. The cat increased its run, arcing and flexing like a black banner behind a kite, and then stopped, not out of its own volition, but because it had run into an invisible surface, the cat pouring its momentum against that impasse, spreading in concentric waves, losing form and coherence. Something like astonishment dropped Garland's jaw. He held the stance, the cat, like some fast liquid stream that had hit glass. The black remained splashed and curdled, but did not reform. Garlin maintained his stiff-armed posture until there seemed no possibility of the cat reconstituting itself. Then he angled his arm down, flexing and reflexing his fingers as if he did not quite understand what he had done, or what might yet lie within his capabilities.
"I remembered,"
he said, with a sort of astonished reverence.
"I knew what to do. I just wished it to stop."
Dreyfus took his first breath in at least 20 seconds. "You used to play the same games, Julius. If Caleb can speak to quick matter, then so can you." Garlin was still working his fingers, curling and uncurling them in a strange and restless fascination, as if some electric power now lay within his grasp, and he could not quite bring himself to stop enjoying the novel, tingling thrill of it. He let out a small, quiet gasp.
"Caleb will have sensed you, I think," Dreyfus said.
"If he didn't already know you were present,
But you have the edge, for now. See if you can do something about that jungle, will you? Before any more cats come back.
Garlin turned and raised his hand at the now impenetrable wall, where the whiphound had tried to excavate a corridor. His eyes narrowed with concentration, his jaw set with determination and a dangerous, self-admiring charisma. The jungle puckered in, resisted, like an elastic surface, rebounding after a punch, and then formed the corridor into itself. Dreyfus looked at Garlin, glad that they had been spared the cat, but equally certain that something was now loose, over which none of them, most especially Devon Garlin, had any sort of sovereignty.
"Let's go," Dreyfus said.
Chapter 22. The man who insisted that he be thought of as Julius Devon Garlin Voy placed a comradely hand on Sparva's back.
"They're here, my little friend, from Panoply. Three of them, one that I know as well as my own shadow. They've defeated the cats by various means. I could send more, create an overpowering force of them, but that would be churlish, after all the trouble they've gone to."
He squeezed Sparva's shoulder, a little too forcefully for the gesture to feel anything but bullying. "We'll see how strong he really is." He made a sweeping, theatrical gesture in the direction of the spiralling property. "Let's take a stroll to the shell house, shall we? And if I said no, I could pull you apart like straw, make you squeal with the best of them. Admit it. You do have some curiosity. You must be asking yourself why I chose those particular wild firecases out of all the 100 million citizens. If there's a reason, I'm sure it makes perfect sense to you."
Something twitched in the cheek of the man's broad but familiar face. "A bad thing was done, Prefect. A secret clandestine crime. It came to a culmination with the birth of my brother and I, but we were not the start of it."
They crossed the level, manicured ground before the shell house, then went up onto the paved terrace fronting the main entrance. Sparva had debated his options for escape or resistance, and concluded they were non-existent, given the man's demonstrable control over every aspect of his environment.
"If you know about a crime, you should have reported it through the official channels," Sparva said.
The man, walking alongside him now, favoured him with a pitying smile.
"It would have been damaging for the Voy family, and we couldn't accept that."
"Isn't that what you're hoping for now?"
"Yes, but it's later now. Much later."
The man gave a soft, mocking laugh.
"No, it was my justice, or none at all."
They went in through the main doors, into a cool, shaded lobby, with black and white floor tiles, decorated plasterwork and an impressive staircase at one end.
"It might help if I knew what sort of crime we were talking about."
"There was a, let's call it a gambling syndicate, a group of citizens dedicated to the art of the wager, staking ever higher bets on increasingly unlikely or speculative outcomes. Their craving was an addiction, an appetite that could be dulled, but never satiated." Sparva thought of the linking connection between the wildfire cases, the propensity for risk, but rather than interject, decided it was wiser to let his host keep talking. Their desires demanded an endless supply of new forms of competitive diversion. At first, these could be met through legal means, placing wagers on games and challenges that would not have troubled any of the law enforcement bodies. But in the long run, that was insufficient. They had gone through an arched doorway into a connecting room now, and the man paused at one of the ornamented panels in the wall. It had a pastel backing, with scrolling decoration around the borders. He touched a hand to it, and the panel slid aside, an operation that struck Sparva as surprisingly cumbersome and mechanical. Beyond was a dark sloping passage, descending into the basement levels of the house.
"Go on, Prefect,"
the man said, giving him an encouraging shove. "I insist you bear witness, if nothing else. It's that, or cease to be of use to me." They walked down the sloping passage. It went down some way, then reversed direction and continued descending, carrying on until they were obviously deep within the bedrock under the domed enclosure. "There was a figure within the consortium," the man went on, his tone of address still affable enough. "A man who shared the acute desires of his fellows for novelty and risk, but who was also in a position to provide them, at least up to a point. He became the consortium's facilitator. It was he who proposed the final wager, the darkest game of them all. Shall I tell you this man's name? They had come to a heavy utilitarian door at the base of the sloping corridor. Wild guess, Sparva said. Marlon Voy? My father. Our father, I should say. Marlon had the dual benefits of prestige and long habits of secrecy. He came here, to this little rock. He owned it already, so that wasn't a problem. But he still needed all his resourcefulness to lay the ground for the final wager. The man unlocked the heavy door. A draft of cold, stale air hit Sparva, and a crack of dim golden light pushed through as the door opened. And this wager was? The settling of an age-old question, the man said, ushering Sparva through into the chamber beyond. Are you intimately acquainted with the early history of our settlement, Prefect? I hear it didn't end well. Corridors and rooms radiated away from the chamber beyond the door. The man closed the door behind them, and at once it became impossible to tell it was there at all, leaving only a row of grey panels along one wall. Sparva took in his surroundings, conscious that he seemed to have stepped back a few hundred years compared to the elegant furnishings of the shell house. These corridors and rooms were made of angular, prefabricated components, with grilled vents, caged ceiling lights, and snaking lines of cables and pipes stapled to the walls. Now and then there was a window, set within an armoured frame. The environment hummed with the throb of generators and air circulators. It gave off a steely, antiseptic stench. You would certainly not call it a shining success, the man said, steering Sparva to one of the windows. There was some sort of shutter on the other side of the glass, but the man worked a control, and the metal protection whisked aside with a solid clunk. For once, the window was set at a height that easily suited Sparva. Beyond was an alien landscape, stretching impossibly far into the distance. Do you recognize it? Someone sent me a postcard once. It's Yellowstone. The man seemed pleased by this observation, enough to reinforce the desired impression, which was that the children were present on the surface of that world, in a settlement made by robots. It worked well enough, at least for the first few test generations. I don't understand. The man worked the control and sealed the window shutter again. In a short while I'll ask you to excuse me, Prefect, while I go and greet Caleb and his guests. But we're not quite done. Down here. There's a small favour I'm going to ask of you in a moment. You might almost say it relates to a private wager of my own. A sudden eager interest showed itself in his face. Tell me, have you grasped the point of this, of Marlon's last game?
You mentioned generations.
I did, and for good reason. Boys and girls would be created, born, and then immediately placed in this simulation. They would know nothing but these walls, no companionship but themselves, no guidance beyond that offered by the robots, the Ursas. The parameters would vary from run to run, the outcome monitored, and those that wagered on a particular result would be rewarded, or penalized. They walked away from the window, through a connecting bulkhead, heavy as an airlock, and painted with black and yellow stripes, into another part of the complex. Therapies were applied to make the boys and girls reach maturity more rapidly. A spread of wages covered all eventualities. Fortunes were banked, egos nailed to the mast of one outcome over another. They were walking through what Sparva decided must be some sort of infirmary, lined as it was with couches, beds, and antique-looking items of surgical equipment. And the generations? What happened to those boys and girls? They were painlessly euthanized at the end of each run, and a new batch prepared. Sparva swallowed his distaste.
But you were one of them. How did you get out?
The problems had been building for some while, until at least there was a... The man paused, his throat moving, tension bunching the muscles around his mouth. A massacre. A psychotic episode. The other children butchered. Just two survivors out of the whole run. Caleb and myself, with knives in our hands, standing amid the blood-spattered bodies of our fellows. Even for the refined tastes of the consortium, that was just a little too much. The man allowed himself an ironic smile. It was the end of the wager, the end of the whole enterprise. Everyone bailed. desperate to unsoil their hands of this regrettable episode. Pacts of secrecy, threats of dark recrimination, should a word of this escape to the wider world. An agreement that the members of the consortium would seek voluntary amnesiac therapy to blot out any knowledge of their involvement. It worked, for the most part. They forgot their part in it all. There was just one lingering snag.
Somehow you and your brother didn't die.
The man gave an appreciative nod. Marlon grew a late conscience. He wanted to atone for his part in the spectacle. What better way than to redeem the two boys? So he took us, and, with the reluctant consent of Alia, who had never been more than an unwilling bystander in the wager, it was agreed that we would be raised as their own sons, which, in a sense, we already were. Marlon and Alia had contributed genetic information to the project, as had the other participants. We were true-blooded boys, just not born of our mother's womb.
But you knew what you were.
Not after we'd been put through a round of the same sort of amnesiac therapy. We were given a second phase of conditioning, reinforced with a second lie, that we had been born in the shell house, that we were the natural heirs of the old lineage. And for a little while, neither of us ever questioned that story, not until the bad dreams started haunting our nights. At the far end of the infirmary, the man touched a control, and another door opened. He beckoned for Sparva to step through into the narrow, red-lit chamber beyond. Sparva did so without resistance, even as he took in the room's sole occupant, and by a series of mental leaps deduced who that person must be.
"Marlon," Sparva said.
"You're not slow, Prefect, I'll give you that, and I'll credit you for not stating the obvious, which is that Marlon Voy is supposed to be dead.
It doesn't look much like living to me."
"I doubt that he'd disagree with you, in those rare moments when he entertains a lucid thought." Marlon Voy was a husk, a shriveled grey form propped up on an angled bed, his sightless eyes fixed on the ceiling. A grey blanket covered all but his head and shoulders, with wires and nutrient lines feeding into him from the banks of archaic medical devices positioned around the bed. Other than a door at the other end of the chamber, there was nothing in the room not related to the immediate business of life support. Screens flickered with pulse profiles and neural graphs. Monitors chirped and beeped in a low, lulling chorus. In one machine, centrifuge wheels spun, while in another, bellows moved up and down in a slow, huffing rhythm. A transparent mask fitted over the mouth and nose of the skull-like head, cased within a cushioned frame. The half-collapsed, leathery tube of his neck seemed incapable of ever supporting the weight of that head.
"It's inhuman."
Quite a statement coming from a hyper-pig. The man moved to the bedside and adjusted some of the settings on the monitors. Next to this monitor was a fold-out tray, holding a number of sharp surgical instruments, laid out on a green cloth.
"You know what I meant, Garlin."
Sparva was debating his chances of reaching one of those instruments and doing something useful with it.
"Julius, Caleb, whoever you are, whatever you think he did, you aren't the one who gets to decide his punishment."
The man looked surprised. "I thought that was exactly what I'd been doing all these years. Still, would you agree that he's suffered enough, all things considered?" Seeing his moment, Sparva made a lunge for the tray, but the man was faster. He grabbed Sparva's arm and twisted it sharply, sending a crunching pain through his shoulder.
"No, not that easily, but I don't blame you for trying."
The man released the pressure on his arm, while leaving Sparva in no doubt that his host would always be faster and stronger. "I mentioned that private wager of my own. May I elaborate?
I'm all ears.
I'm told they're hard to miss. When Marlon designed this place, he took precautions. He arranged that the habitable parts of Lethe could be destroyed very easily and very quickly by triggering a generator overload. That way, if anyone got too close, the evidence could be eliminated in one stroke.
And now?
I have arranged for the generators to overload. In 30 minutes, there will be a small but not insignificant fusion event. It will cause quite a lot of damage to Lethe. Marlon will die, and so will I, and anyone else unfortunate enough to still be inside this rock. So, my friend, will you,
if you are still present. Unless you're planning on letting me go, I guess that's a foregone conclusion.
True, but you have neglected one detail. You have learned of Marlon's crimes now, and that makes you a witness. There would have been no point my bringing you here unless I intended that you should convey this testimony beyond Lethe. My word would have meant nothing but yours. The word of a prefect? Hate to break it to you, Julius, but I doubt that 30 minutes would give me time to get halfway to that elevator, even if it was ready to take me to the docking point. No, you are right about that. But there's another way out of here, another of Marlon's little precautions. He nodded to the chamber's end. Do you see that door? It leads to an escape device, a single-person life pod, ready to be ejected from Lethe with a centrifugal kick. Sparva thought of the redoubts he had seen from the cruiser. We scanned your rock. If there was an escape tunnel, we'd have seen it. You scanned for density variations. The tunnel is sealed with fine-grained rubble, indistinguishable from the surrounding rock. When the capsule is ready to depart, a pressure seal is blown at the far end. The rubble spills out, and the life pod follows a few moments later.
Good, Sparva said. Any objections if I get into it right now? I mean, if you're planning on dying, and he's going at the same time.
I'm afraid it's not quite that simple. You're right that Marlon's essential fate is sealed. But here's an interesting ethical dilemma. My private wager, if you like. Under the present arrangements, that door won't open until Marlon is dead. It's linked to the life support systems. The point of which is, you'll have to kill him to save yourself. Oh, he'll die anyway. That's plain. But it's not quite the same thing, is it? You'd be killing a man many minutes before his allotted moment. If it was years, or even months, we'd have no hesitation in calling it murder. But taking minutes off a life? Where does that put you?
In the shit, most likely.
You have a delicate turn of phrase, I'll give you that. Still, it's not just your own life at stake. Get out now, soon, and you might be able to do something, effect some course of action, however futile it's likely to prove. But you'll have considered that already, factored it into your moral calculus. You've obviously mistaken me for a deep thinker. Is it possible you've got the wrong pig? The man attended to one of the life support devices, triggering a subtle but definite shift in the pattern of monitoring noises, like a change from a minor to a major key in a melody. I'm restoring him to consciousness now, Sparva. There wouldn't be any point in you killing him if he were not capable of understanding his fate. I can't promise you the most enlightening of conversations. He's too far gone for that. But you'd be the one doing most of the talking in any case.
What about you?
Pressing business awaits. I have to go and attend to Caleb. Give my brother the welcome he deserves. The man turned from the figure that he claimed was his father. Kill him as and when you see fit. I've left you ample means to do so. They say that the pigs lack the capacity for truly creative thought, but I'm sure you'll give the lie to that.
You might have overestimated this pig, Sparva said.
Then this is your chance to rise to the occasion. The man began to step out of the red-lit chamber. But I wouldn't take too long about it.
At last they broke through the final layer of the jungle, and the shell house stood within view. Dreyfus took a moment to compare it with his memories of the crumbling ruin inside Chasm City, certain that the two structures were identical in all significant respects, but unable to shake the impression that this version was by far the larger of the pair. Perhaps it was the cleanliness of the spiraling architecture, burnished to a hard luster under the blazing blue of the dome, that made it appear grander, more substantial, more fitting of the family name to which it belonged. Garlin paused with his hands on his knees, mentally and physically drained by the effort of resisting the jungle. Dreyfus did not doubt that the task had taken its toll. Equally, he had watched Garlin grow in confidence and fluency as his buried skills reasserted themselves. This was more than just the supple, offhand faculty with quick matter that any wealthy son might have had drummed into him since birth, like an aptitude for dueling or cruel put-downs. It went much deeper than that. Garlin was relearning a virtuoso talent, one that would have been impressive enough
even if it had concerned itself with the ordinary, willing quick matter of the glitter-abandoned Chasm City. But this quick matter was supposedly slaved to the will of Garlin's brother alone. And yet he had learned to shape it, to twist its narrow loyalty from one sibling to the other. And he had been getting better at it, Dreyfus knew.
I suppose,
Garlin said, pausing between breaths, sweat prickling his brow through the M-suit visor.
I suppose, if ever there was a time to admit that Stasov was right.
I don't blame you for resisting the truth, Dreyfus said. You were under the influence of multiple amnesia treatments. But I think we can both agree that there must have been something in Dr. Stasov's account.
Garlin straightened up. My brother's nearby, Dreyfus. I can feel him crawling around in my head.
Singh, who was standing next to Garlin, offered an arm while he regained his strength. She had lifted up the visor on her tactical armor, deciding, reasonably, it seemed to Dreyfus, that the breathability or otherwise of the air was the least of her worries. It was the first time he'd had a good look at her face, and he chastised himself for misremembering her name from the induction classes. She looked small in that helmet, far too young to be put through this.
Thank you,
Garlin murmured, with what to Dreyfus seemed like genuine gratitude and surprise at her kindness.
Sir, it's Prefect Beric,
Singh said, nodding as she drew his attention to a body on the ground. There was a tremble in her voice.
I can see part of her name, and that's definitely not Koba. Do you think Prefect Bankal made it this far, sir? He only had an M-suit.
Doesn't look like that armor helped any of you, Dreyfus observed.
He's here,
Garlin said, as a well-built man stepped out of the main entrance of the shell house, walking casually across the raised terrace, dusting one palm against the other, as if he had recently finished some manual labor. The man wore a simple black outfit of trousers and tunic, with the tunic low-slashed from the collar, emphasizing a powerful chest. His forearms were bare, the tunic sleeves rolled to the elbow. His muscles flexed as he worked his palms together.
Caleb, Dreyfus said, recognizing the family connection, even though this man looked much older than Garlin, more like a father than a brother.
The man spread his hands and raised his right by way of greeting.
You've got it wrong, Prefect, he said,
a wry, knowing smile crinkling the skin at the corner of his eyes.
Or did my brother not remember which of us is which? He's Julius Devon Garlin Voy,
Dreyfus said, but with a steadily draining conviction, thinking of the instances when his witness had indeed seemed confused or indecisive about his identity.
That makes you Caleb, if Caleb isn't an invention of Dr. Stasov's.
The man stepped down from the terrace, striding towards the party.
Caleb's real enough, Dreyfus.
His smile intensified.
Yes, I'm aware of you. I've been aware of you for a great while. Shall I clarify a few things?
Clarify what you like, Dreyfus said. As of this moment, you are under panoply observance. The man touched his lip, frowning.
And the meaning of that is what, exactly?
You'll come back with me to Panoply, where we'll talk about the remaining wildfire cases, and what you're going to do to keep those people alive. The man made a show of belated understanding, like someone getting the punchline to a not particularly good joke.
Oh, I see. With you. In your unarmed state, after most of your force has already been depleted.
The man winked. Between you and me, Dreyfus, you're not really in a position to make demands. The man came to a halt, standing 10 meters from the trio. Garlin watched him with a surprising stillness, saying nothing for the moment. With her visor still lifted up, her eyes wide, Singh looked like a startled baby bird glimpsing the open sky for the first time, in all its limitless splendor and terror.
I suppose there's a point to these deaths, Dreyfus asked.
It's here, the man said, nodding and smiling.
It's happening. Destruction and chaos. That's all I ever wanted.
There's more to it than that. You selected those wildfire cases, lured them to your clinic. That was yours, wasn't it?
The man started to answer, then made a quick flicking gesture with his hand.
Do you mind, Dreyfus, if we dispense with these needless barriers to effective communication?
Dreyfus did not have time to answer.
His M-suit peeled away around him, leaving him wearing only the ordinary uniform of his profession. Next to him, Garland's M-suit suffered the same ruthless obliteration, blowing off him like sea foam.
"There, much better," the man declared.
"My brother has a soiling sense of his own competence, you see. Just because he bettered the cats and persuaded my jungle to dance to his fingers does not make him the stronger of us, although once he liked to think he was." There came the quick flash of a smile, but now it was loaded with venom.
"Tell him, Caleb, did the crossbow ring any bells?"
"They were my idea," Garland said. "The crossbows, the animals, the hunting games. He didn't want to go along with me."
"He?" the older man quizzed. "Julius," Garland said, almost coughing the name, as if it took an effort of will to force it out of his lips.
"You, Julius. We were the same age, but you were smaller, more timid, more interested in books and stories.
Tell them about the story I used to go on about, Caleb.
The one you didn't like me mentioning." Garland, the man Dreyfus was now having to adjust to thinking of as Caleb Foy, turned to him with a look of almost desperate hopelessness in his eyes, the last lingering traces of swagger and disdain sucked out of him by this meeting with his brother, who claimed the name Julius Foy.
"We'd been born in the Americano era," Caleb said, "in one of their settlements, tended and raised by robots, until it went wrong and we murdered the other children."
"He's both right and wrong, Dreyfus,"
Julius said, fingering the slashed collar of his tunic. "We shared those dreams, shared those memories. They were real, it turned out. But we were born less than 60 years ago and put into a simulation of the Americano colony, so that our father and his friends might place wagers on the outcome." Caleb, the man Dreyfus had brought from Panoply, shook his head.
"He's lying, Dreyfus. I'd know, wouldn't I?"
"If such a thing happened," Dreyfus said, "it would explain both your disturbed memories and your genetic connection to Marlon and Alia Voy."
"You see," Julius said, applauding silently.
"Dreyfus sees it instantly.
Bravo, Prefect. I like a man who isn't afraid to embrace the truth, however unpalatable."
"Let's get back to the clinic," Dreyfus answered.
"You're right. That was mine. I set up Elysium Heights using seed money from the Voya estate, as you realized." Julius's eyes twinkled in vain amusement at his own ingenuity. "I also wanted you to find it, Dreyfus, knowing the poor light it would place my brother in. That's why the chain of ownership was cloudy, but not too cloudy, and why you were given a little helping hand with that flood."
The flood that had nearly killed Sparva and Talia, Dreyfus thought, as well as leaving an innocent witness dead. But he fought to keep his voice level, his demeanor detached, as if he were asking routine questions in the interview suite.
"And the people on the clinical list?" "Former members of a consortium. A covert, highly elite gambling ring with close ties to our father. Not all active participants, but all aware of it, all fully cognizant of the darker aspects of that particular enterprise. They were the ones who wagered on my brother and I, you see, and on the other children. We were there to fend off their boredom."
Dreyfus shook his head. "I looked into the backgrounds of the wildfire victims. There were no prior associations beyond chance encounters, and certainly no membership of gambling syndicates."
Julius looked pained, like a music tutor, affronted by a sudden sour note.
"That's because it was secret, Dreyfus. When the wager came to an end, such was the danger of disclosure that each and every member of the syndicate submitted to voluntary amnesia."
"And the clinic?"
"Allure, you slow, stupid man. My means of getting back into their heads. I knew their names, because I was a Voy, and they had all come to Lethe. They were ripe for it, desperate for someone to put an end to their darker desires. And they came, all of them. In ones, naturally, never once guessing what connected them to the other patients."
"You're a monster," Singh said.
"But a patient one. Surely you'll allow me that one virtue."
"Is it all true?" Caleb said. "Are you really responsible for these deaths?"
"Crocodile tears," Julius said scornfully, "hoping they'll buy you some late sympathy from Dreyfus. That's all it is, Caleb."
I know you far too well to think anything else, brother. I know exactly how manipulative you can be. Then to Dreyfus. Did you wonder about the significance of the crossbow by any chance? Should I have done? Ask Caleb what happened to our mother, Prefect. Then you'll understand.
Sparva watched for a clear sign of animation in the eyes of Marlon Voy. Not sight. He doubted very much that those eyes were capable of seeing anything. But an involuntary attention, a twitching that had not been there a moment before. Sparva loosened the breathing mask a little, holding it by one hand, while his other held one of the surgical knives that had been provided for him. His shoulder ached where the man had wrenched it, but he still had functionality in both arms.
"Marlon Voy," he said softly. "Can you hear me, Marlon? I'm Prefect Bancal. You're in Lethe. I guess you know that."
Marlon made a long, low, sucking sound, a sound less like human breathing than the gurgling of ancient plumbing, rattling and wet from decades of neglect. He shaped a word. Sparva leaned in closer, loosening the mask by a further degree.
"Kill,"
the word was, followed after another labored inhalation by
"me."
The deed would not have been difficult. Sparva could have killed the man directly, or he could have cut some of the connections between Marlon and the life support equipment. Either way, he doubted it would need more than a few minutes to arrive at the same terminal conclusion.
"He wants me to,"
Sparva said. "Your son says he's Julius and that you deserve everything he's done to you."
"I don't know about that, exactly. Was it true, Marlon? Was there a syndicate? A sick game played out across generations of children?"
He made the words again. This time there was more conviction to them, sounding less like a plea than an order, delivered in the full and certain expectation that it would be obeyed.
"Kill me."
"Old habits, Marlon. That's what it sounds like to me. Not asking, but telling. As if that's all the rest of us exist for. Doing what you demand of us."
"Julius, right. Kill me."
Marlon Voy clawed another meager ration of air into the fetid reservoirs of his lungs.
"I deserve it. Did a terrible thing. But understand."
The last word had been almost too faint to hear.
"What? Alia never wanted this."
"She's dead and gone, Marlon. Past all justice, just as we all thought you were. She is gone, isn't she?"
"Julius. Killed."
He paused, long enough that, for a moment at least, Sparva wondered if he had in fact died between utterances, sparing him this ethical quandary.
"Ha!
I believe you," Sparva said.
"Then kill me. Now."
Sparva looked at the door. He had been presented with an extremely simple choice, and the means of facilitating it lay in his hand, sharp and clean as a spacecraft exhaust. It was a long shot, but if he took the escape capsule, he might be able to get word to Panoply, warning them of the imminent explosion. Even if he failed, he would certainly save his own life. But in doing so, he would have to kill a living witness. There ought to have been no hesitation. Marlon Voy was going to die anyway, and the time left to him was a lot less than 30 minutes. The blade weighed heavily in Sparva's grip. He moved closer to the man, slipping the mask back into place, muffling it with his other hand, so that he did not have to hear Marlon's distress as he did what needed to be done. And he began to cut. "Alia Voy died here," Dreyfus stated. "The shuttle accident was a ruse to conceal the circumstances and location of her death." "Was it murder?"
"Of a sort," Julia said. "Ask Caleb. Ask him who fired the fatal shot. Assuming he even remembers." "You killed her,"
Caleb said, surprised and certain in the same moment, as if a very clear memory had just presented itself.
"Did I, brother?"
"Yes. You shot her with the crossbow. I can see it now. The look on your face."
He shook his head, aghast.
I don't want to remember, but I do. It's this place, bringing it all back again. She felt we'd come too far, too fast. There was something in us that she didn't trust.
Something in you, Julius corrected. Perhaps. But you were the one who shot her. If she revoked my privileges, she'd have revoked yours as well. You were afraid of that, so you killed her before she had a chance. After that, Father didn't have a chance. He was too horrified to think clearly. Caleb drew a breath, squaring his shoulders. There was something bad in both of us, Julius. Nothing can excuse the things they did to us. But you've gone too far. Stop this now.
Let the other people live.
It's too late, Caleb, he said more in regret than anger. Were you not listening just now? I steered Dreyfus to the clinic. Once that was done, it was only a matter of time before he fumbled his way to Lethe. I always knew this day, this hour, would come, and I'm ready to die rather than leave.
Dreyfus won't touch you.
Julius glared at his brother. Then why did he come? To reason with you, Dreyfus said, to find out what had driven you to this point, to confirm your brother's innocence, insofar as the wildfire cases go, to see if there was any persuasion I could bring to bear, without incurring the use of force. He offered his hands, empty of any threat. I'd still like you to come with us. We have an emergency action in progress to safeguard the remaining victims. We can get the implants out of their heads given time. But you need to help us. The wildfire incidences have been steepening, and that's surely been your doing, turning the screw on us. But act now, act swiftly. And if we see a leveling off in the death curve, I'll note that you cooperated. And would that earn me a pardon? I can't ignore the murders that have already happened, the wildfire cases, or the deaths incidental to this investigation. But we'll look into the syndicate's wager. You were victims of a crime before any of this began, and that has to count in your favor. A demonstrable show of remorse now. A pledge to assist.
You misunderstand me, Dreyfus, Julia said. I don't want your leniency. I don't want anything from you.
You can leave or remain. The choice is yours. But my work is done.
He knows something,
Caleb said. I can feel it seeping out of him. It doesn't matter to him what happens now. He doesn't even care if you try to kill him or not. His eyes narrowed with a dawning comprehension.
He's expecting to die.
This is all just... Julius made a swatting gesture, as if a fly had just troubled him. Caleb groaned and dropped to his knees, clutching at the sides of his head in obvious agony. I've had enough of him again, Julius said, addressing his audience with an abashed, confiding look. Funny how it goes with family. You don't see them for years and years, and you think it will be different. All the old irritations set aside. But he's the same old Caleb he always was. Thinks he's the master of me, the one with all the ideas. Caleb rolled onto his side, whimpering. Stop, Dreyfus said, moving to kneel down next to Caleb. He doesn't deserve this.
Doesn't he?
Julius was holding his arm outstretched, his fingers cradled around an invisible mass, squeezing it gently, almost as if he were reaching into Caleb's skull and applying some unspeakable pressure to his brain. He was coy about the exact circumstances of Mother's death. Told you some of the facts, but not all of them. He was right about one thing. It was my hand on the crossbow, my finger on the trigger. I put that dart into her. I killed her. But I didn't mean to. It was an accident, Dreyfus asked, while Caleb drooled and groaned, thrashing along the length of his body. He placed a hand on him, trying to find a way to offer comfort. No, not an accident at all. He reached into my head, just as I'm reaching into his now. He altered my visual field, made me see a cat instead of our mother, made me take aim, as if I were still playing one of his hunting games, made me drop the cat. I was pleased for a second or two. I was always trying to impress him. Then we went over to see the body, and I saw what I had done. I killed her,
but it was his idea, his intention.
I'm sorry, Dreyfus said, looking up from the writhing form. But this won't make it any better.
Let him go.
Stop it, Singh said pleadingly. Whatever he did, it doesn't excuse...
A rumble ran through the ground. Julius, distracted for an instant, turned back to the shell house. Something between surprise and admiration played across his features.
Did you feel that, Dreyfus?
It was the escape capsule departing Lethe.
I don't know what you mean,
Dreyfus said. Your man, your pig. I presented him with a choice, a simple one. I'm more than a little surprised he took the path he did, though. If I'm being honest with myself, I was convinced he'd hold on to his principles to the end, even if it meant dying and surrendering any means of contacting your organization. That vibration we just felt was the escape shaft blowing out, allowing the capsule to fall away from Lethe. It could only have happened if your colleague was prepared to commit murder to save his own skin.
Sparva wouldn't have done that,
Dreyfus said. Why not?
Because he's not a piece of self-interested dirt. Because he's my friend. Because he's a prefect.
Oh, don't be so sure. People will do all sorts of things in extremis. And I really did stress to him that it was only a small murder in the great scheme of things. Behind Julius, a figure emerged into daylight from the shell house. It was Sparva, his hands lathered in blood all the way to the elbows. Dreyfus watched, glad that his colleague was alive, but that gladness tempered by thoughts of exactly what had transpired below. Casually, Sparva allowed some small, glinting thing to drop from his hand.
"You got me wrong," he said, calling to the brother who had his back to the house. "You needn't have troubled yourself, Julius. You see, it wasn't a question of whether or not to murder your father. That was secondary. To me, it was all about evidential preservation."
Julius bent round, distracted by this unexpected development, shaking his head as if he meant to teach Sparva a lesson in manners.
"What?"
"I killed him, just like you wanted me to, but only so I could stuff his body into that capsule. It's out there now, and it's my guess it won't be more than a few minutes before someone from Panoply reaches it, cracks it open, and realizes what's inside."
"You put Marlin in that thing?" Dreyfus asked.
"Yes," Sparva answered. "He'd been kept alive in the basement. I had to kill him to get out of here, but I did so in the reasonable expectation of emergency intervention."
Dreyfus nodded. "Good work."
"One other thing," Sparva said. "There's a fusion reactor set to blow.
We don't have too long. Did you get word to Panoply?"
Sparva glanced down at his hands again, as if only just noticing the degree to which they were bloodied.
"I did my best, boss. Scratched out a message. Trouble is, I only had one thing to scratch it on." "No!"
Julius raged. Then an odd, grimacing look took hold on his face. He twisted back to address Dreyfus and Singh, his mouth twitching, but no sounds emerging. Now it was his turn to buckle at the knees, sinking to the ground, his eyes bulging obscenely large and white in their sockets. Caleb had stopped writhing. He had seen his opportunity and snatched it. Now he pressed himself up by an elbow, and with the other hand reached out in a beseeching gesture that reminded Dreyfus of the outstretched hand of Adam in a painting he had once seen. Julius toppled back, squirming under the mounting neural assault from his brother. Caleb, regaining confidence and authority, propped himself up on his knees and then rose shakily to his feet.
"Don't kill him," Dreyfus urged. "We need him to keep those people alive."
Caleb adopted a wide stance, loosening his shoulders and neck like a man preparing for a brawl. He was still reaching out, still inflicting some dreadful punishment on Julius. Then, with his other hand, carelessly, as if it cost him no effort at all, he gestured at the upper levels of the shell house. Instantly, the quick matter lost coherence, sluicing away in white cataracts. Caleb steered his hand, the play of his fingers like a virtuoso, conjuring more and more of the upper layers to collapse away. The house was melting. No, Dreyfus corrected himself. That wasn't it, exactly. It was more as if the house were a form made from liquid, caught in a snapshot, and now time had been allowed to advance, but selectively, only where Caleb gestured. Perhaps the show of skill was a little too cocksure, for all of a sudden Julius seemed to shake loose of Caleb's attack. He stumbled to his feet, one hand at his throat, the other shaping a conjuring gesture in the direction of Caleb. Caleb staggered back, his aim awry and causing him to conjure a black smear in the sky. Julius regained some of his composure. He opened his fists, and some of the white detritus of the shell house veered from its cataracting course and flowed into his hands. He gathered and balled it like dough. The quick matter shaped itself into jagged, lightning-like forms, and Julius hurled them at his brother. Caleb rolled aside in time to avoid the first of the strikes, but not the second. It caught him in the thigh, and he let out a scream composed as much of anguish as it was pain. Glancing away from Julius, he shaped a conjuring gesture and turned the impaling form to black smoke. It curdled away from his leg, but left a coin-sized wound behind. Enraged, Caleb swept the hand across a swath of the jungle where it pressed nearest to the shell house. The organic forms withered under the force of the gesture, turning black and then shrinking and shriveling. With these dramatic conjurations of quick matter came an electric tingle in the air, as well as a warm, unsettled wind, as air molecules were caught up in the crash and flow of matter. Dreyfus glanced at Sparva, questions piling up in his head.
"How long do we have?"
"Less than 30 minutes." Sparva reconsidered.
"A lot less. 12, 15 if we're lucky."
Beneath their feet, the ground was shaking. Some process of self-sustaining collapse had now taken hold within the architecture of the shell house, for the building was continuing to dismantle itself regardless of Caleb's direct instructions. Something similar was at play in the jungle, too. It was dying back, reverting to the condition of primal, unshaped quick matter. Dreyfus watched, mesmerized, as a patch of jungle opened up long enough to permit him a view of two black cats, melting like candles.
"It's no good," Dreyfus said. "The elevator went dead after we arrived."
"I might be able to get back up the shaft on power assist, sir," Singh said.
"I'm sorry, Deepa. There just isn't time."
The disappointment he read in her expression cut him to the marrow.
"That's not what you said before, sir, about never giving up. You said we never get to decide when it's too late. But those were just words, weren't they, to get me moving. You didn't really mean them."
"I meant them,"
Dreyfus said softly. "But I also know when we've lost."
"No,"
said a voice, speaking for the first time since the brothers had commenced their struggle.
"It's not over yet, Dreyfus. I can hold him."
It was Caleb, standing again now, glancing down at the wound in his thigh, then dismissing it as if it were no more consequential than a graze, walking with a limping gait towards Julius, who was also standing, but had something like fear showing in his eyes as he took a step backwards, closer to the last, diminishing traces of the shell house.
"You can't beat me!"
Julius shouted, a strangled quality to his voice.
"Once, maybe, but not since then. I learned too well from you, brother."
Overhead, where it had been wounded, the sky rained curtains of black mist. Slowly that black rot was eating away the blue, turning the brightness of day to an oppressive dusk.
"I know what you are,"
Caleb said, reaching out again with both hands, a gesture that might almost have been one of embrace, except that the brothers were still 6 or 7 meters apart.
"It wasn't enough for you, was it?
You lived and breathed quick matter. You could do wonders with it, judging by this place. But you couldn't resist the final step. It's in you. I can sense it."
"No,"
Julius said. But something unsettling was happening to Julius. He was blurring at the edges, a fine smoke coming off him, breezing away on the shifting winds. The ground shook under Dreyfus, nearly throwing him off his feet, and every instinct in his body screamed for him to run, to find some illusion of shelter, no matter how pointless it might prove.
"Boss,"
Sparva said, pointing at something beyond Dreyfus's line of sight. The brothers stumbled near each other. It was as if each were walking into a gale, being pushed apart, yet both determined to overpower that opposing force.
seeking some final connection. Julius was growing more tenuous. He was losing body mass, a much thinner and frailer human core beginning to show through, as successive layers